First of all, I'd like to apologize for the pre-diluvian technology, but this is not the talk I had actually prepared. I have a PowerPoint presentation, in fact, but I decided to do this, which is going to be a little more pedagogical. And it's going to be a review of some work we did on the BKL approach and its ramifications. I need to get tidied up a little bit. So I understand you already had an introduction to BKL ideas from David Garfinkel and Beverly Berger. And I did look at the transparencies. It means I can probably be a little quicker. Also, I think this work will have a slightly different flavor from what you were talking about. In classical general relativity, one uses this approach mainly to understand the nature of singularities. Now, here the purpose is to generalize this approach to arbitrary matter-coupled gravity systems, and also to find a better interpretation of what it really means, what this expansion spatial gradients could really mean. And in particular, we will exhibit a link between this BKL dynamics and a class of certain class of infinite dimensional Lie algebras. And these are the Lie algebras that will also arise in dimensional reduction of supergravity. So the main emphasis is not about understanding singularities in classical GR, but rather it's about the question what we can learn about the possible symmetries of unified theory, M theory if you like, from an analysis of Einstein's field equations and the solutions in the vicinity of a space-like singularity. And it has been said before that somehow, also in a previous talk, somehow the idea is that there is a certain simplification as you approach the space-like singularity, and maybe this simplification is also there in some sense in the quantum theory. So here I've listed a little bit of literature. This is reviews in classical general relativity, and the work I'm going to talk about has been done in collaboration with Thibaut Damour and Marc Henault. And the stuff, if I really get to it, on higher curvature corrections, that's been done in collaboration with Thibaut Damour. So as I said, this was supposed to be pedagogical. So here's once more the basic idea underlying the BKL approach. We want to understand the behavior of the metric and various other quantities as a space-like singularity is approached, and you have sort of given a generic picture of this, where here the singularities look. This is the initial, if you like, Big Bang hypersurface. And this is sort of cartoon of what the light cones look like. And in fact, this is the picture you always see when people talk about so-called horizon problem in inflationary cosmology. But this was actually exploited by BKL well before inflation was invented. And the basic idea is that if there's causal decoupling, then in some sense this should mean that the spatial gradients should become small or negligible in comparison to the time derivatives. Which means that in this limit, t to zero, where t is the proper time, so singularity occurs at t equals zero, this would result in a drastic simplification of the Einstein field equations in the sense that a complicated partial differential equation is reduced to a continuous superposition of ordinary differential equations. So here's the Kasner solution once more. So I'm sure you've seen it many times by now. Well, actually, I shouldn't say too much about it. So here it is. And here you have the Kasner conditions. And this serves as the simplest example of a Big Bang singularity. Now, so So BKL had this idea. Of course, they realized this is the pure cosmos solution, which means it's the solution that just depends on one time coordinate. It was already found more than 80 years ago. But of course, they realized this couldn't be the whole story here. And so what they also did, they tested the stability of this Kasner ansatz in not just with a pure Kasner solution, but also with a homogeneous curved spatial geometry. So it's slightly more complicated, next more complicated thing after flat space. And what they did to do this, they substituted the, so they took a metric with a Bianchi type solution with a homogeneous curve, homogeneous space, which is curved. They substitute the Kasner-like ansatz into this solution in order to check whether it's really true that spatial gradients become small in comparison to time derivatives. So what you do is you take the Einstein equations, write the time derivatives on one side and the spatial derivatives on the other, and then you, with this ansatz, you check whether it is indeed true that spatial gradients become small. Now, if you look at the way they did it, the Kasner coefficients are such that there's always a negative one there, which is actually what Ted told you about. As you approach the singularities, there's one direction which things get stretched, although overall the volume decreases to zero, like t squared. So it turns out that this approximation does break down every now and then, and what you have is, so here you model the metric with a simple Kasner behavior, then in the vicinity of the, or close to where this happens, you have to look at more slightly more complicated set of equations, and the whole system can be modeled like this. You have a sort of Liouville type potential. So here's the Kasner coefficient, and then something happens, and after this you come out with another set of Kasner coefficients, and this is called a Kasner bounce. So the dynamics in this approximation is modeled as a sequence of Kasner flights and Kasner bounces. And now there are two possibilities as you approach the singularity. Either these bounces occur an infinite number of times as you approach the singularity, or otherwise there's a finite number of bounces after which there are no more bounces, which means that for there exists an epsilon sufficiently small such when the time parameter is between 0 and epsilon, there are no more bounces, and this is what's called asymptotically velocity dominated AVD. So of course in four-dimensional gravity what they found is actually that this was the case. There's an infinite number of oscillations as you approach the singularity, and this is what's referred to as chaotic oscillations of the metric. Now, on the other hand, you see if this is the case, then of course we have a certain simplification, and then you can indeed describe the singularity, or you can approximate it or model it. If your time parameter is sufficiently small, that means that the metric can be more or less written in this form, but with Kasner coefficients that depend on where you are, on the spatial coordinate, and then the metric is essentially of this type plus lower order corrections, which are entirely controllable. And examples of such spacetimes have been studied in the past, and I think they were also presented in your talk, Gaudi type models, but these are simplifications of four-dimensional space-time geometry. So in some sense, this is the case that's under control, and this is the case where one cannot really prove any theorems, because you would have to somehow model a Kasner coefficient which switches or bounces an infinite number of times between this short time, proper time interval. So
in the Bianchi case, you said all Bianchi models have this kind of behavior. Does it include Bianchi, so-called Bianchi class B model, which do not have Hamiltonian framework?
Oh, no, I'm not sure about that. They took a particular geometry.
The only Bianchi, do you know?
I'm not sure about
that. Some Bianchi types have mixed master behavior and some don't. So one, which is faster, doesn't nine, which is expensive,
Anyway, as I said, we're not interested in proving rigorous theorems, but in order to, we're more interested in developing an effective description of this. And this is now what I'm going to do next. Well, as we know, Einstein's equations are, of course, much more complicated than would be suggested by this simple solution. There are, first of all, spatial inhomogeneities. It's been much talked about here. The metric is, in general, not just diagonal. There are off-diagonal components. And then there are all kinds of matter fields as we encounter them in the standard model. So in order to model this situation, we proceed from the following type of ansatz for the metric. So you see in a special gauge, we write it like this, where the space part now is not simply a Kasner-type ansatz, but here we have a sort of spatial frame, which is supposed to parameterize the off-diagonal components of the metric. And as one will see, is that this part freezes as one goes to the singularity. So one has a certain control. There's a part, certain parts of the variables where nothing much happens as you approach the singularity. And in some sense, all the action takes place in this prefactor, which is supposed to contain the Kasner coefficients. So for this picture, we will now reinterpret these logarithmic scale factors as coordinates in some fictitious d-dimensional space, where little d labels the number of space dimensions, in such a way that the time evolution, as you approach the singularity, can be thought of as a motion in this beta space. Now, as you will know, this beta space is nothing but a reduced version of the Wheeler-DeWitt superspace of metric. And the aim, if I were to phrase it in the way a high-energy physicist would phrase it, I would say that we're now interested in developing or finding an effective lower-energy description for the diagonal degrees of freedom by, quote-unquote, integrating out the other degrees of freedom, off-diagonal metric components, matter degrees of freedom, and so on. Now, in this description, just to come back to the Kasner solution, and why this is really a useful picture, the Kasner solution can be described as a kind of free relativistic motion in beta space. Now, remember that the Kasner solution had t to some power here, where t was the proper time, and we now introduce a new time coordinate, namely the minus the logarithm of proper time, called tau, and in order to better describe this evolution. And if you like, this is a kind of Zeno-like coordinate because it stretches the interval between 0 and epsilon from 0 to infinity. So it's like a magnifying glass to study what happens at the singularity. So, and you see that in this description here, the Kasner solution with this new time coordinate really is a motion on a straight line. And this motion is, of course, a constrained motion. It's a relativistic motion. And when you simply substitute this into Einstein equations, which amounts to rederivation of the Kasner conditions, you find that this obeys a relativistic dispersion relation, which is actually nothing but the Kasner condition, in terms of this a certain metric GAB, which is defined by this. Now, the metric GAB, again, is nothing but the Wheeler-DeWitt metric on Wheeler-DeWitt superspace in this simple diagonal truncation. And as you probably also know, is that this metric has Lorentzian signature. If you look at, say, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in such a reduction, it's a hyperbolic equation. And so, indeed, it's really a relativistic dynamics. So the Kasner solution in this description is nothing but the free relativistic, meaning motion, that is the motion of a massless particle in this beta space. So it's just a new kind of description.
This effective field theory is description is important? Or you...
Yes, we will see. Because it will modify this free... you see here we have a free unobstructed motion, but that will get modified by the other degree.
I'm asking is because you know that when we integrate out Master's degrees of freedom, we are penalized. And if you have gauge fields there, they are probably massless.
Well, I think you should not take it too literally. I was just trying to you see the aim is to develop a sort of effective description which is still in terms of just these diagonal logarithmic scale factors. Now the result, and as I said, this is not rigorous but almost rigorous, is the following. Well, modulo some technical assumptions. In the limit indeed t equals 0 really indeed yields a radical simplification. And the dynamics of this whole theory takes place mainly in the space of these diagonal degrees of freedom, whereas the rest, the other degrees of freedom, don't do very much and actually freeze. They do have a limit as the singularity is approached. So one splits somehow the metric better degrees of freedom in such a way that some of them do have limits as you approach the singularity, and others don't. And the ones that don't are essentially the diagonal degrees of freedom, the logarithmic scale factor. And this, to sum up, what you find now is that the free motion, if you take into account this these extra degrees of freedom, is that the free motion gets modified. So it was like this before, and now we have a sort of effective potential that modifies this free motion of this beta particle. Now, in order to figure out what this is, one takes the Einstein theory, or this more general theory, and sets up a Hamiltonian framework for it. And then what one finds is that these potentials essentially look like this. And still very complicated, because simply you've taken the canonical Hamiltonian, and this kind of metric description, and simply split up into the various contributions. But all these contributions, which one sees here, are the following type. There are a certain exponential factors depending on these diagonal, these logarithmic scale factors. And then there are certain prefactors which depend on the other degrees of freedom, momenta, and coordinates. Now, as I said, this is still very complicated. But there are two crucial properties here. Maybe first of all, the leading terms are such that the coefficients here are all positive. And secondly, these exponentials are exponentials of certain linear forms on these functions of these alphas. So I write this as WA, where A labels whatever contribution there is. I write it as a certain linear form, meaning a scalar product, using again the metric as it occurs was given to us from this Wheeler the Witt kind of super.
So what is the last equation? This is WA.
This is WA of beta, and this is the metric. So just, you know, just this Minkowski type scalar product where the components are labeled by A and B.
It's also WA on the right hand side or not?
There's a W, this is WA, which has the label A and the component A. That's simply.
A is a constant on the right-hand side?
This is a constant, yes. It's a linear function of, that's the important thing, it's a linear function of these betas.
The way of saying it's basically an exponential potential. So you get the answers off an exponential.
Yeah, right.
This is a nice geometric way of saying it.
But still, I mean, like, can I just quickly, so you say that there's a more general theory, so you're not doing Einstein theory?
Well, I'm doing Einstein theory with any kind of matter coupling, so you can do it with dilatons, p-form fields, and so on, but bosonic fields. And we're taking a generic Lagrangian that has all these fields in it, but no matter what this theory is, it's always true that these potentials are of the Liouville type, meaning there are potentials that that are exponentials of linear functions.
And in the last transparency, did you make an ansatz for the metric? Or
yes,
not?
Yes.
So do we know that, that does not exclude substantial solutions? Or I just don't...
Well, the moment we're not talking about solutions, we're just talking about the dynamics for these diagonal degrees of freedom for the betas. And so let me repeat what's said here. We try to split the metric and the matter degrees of freedom in a canonical formulation into some set where you have the betas, where the dynamics takes place, and then the others will sort of modify this effective Lagrangian.
What is the source of the positivity of the
coefficient? Well, at this point, I just have to say this not to be that way. In fact, not all of the coefficients are positive. There are also negative ones, but the leading ones are positive. So here's the picture once more. So here's the here's this exponential kind of potential, where so each piece that contributes this to this effective potential is a kind of Liouville exponential, and you really have to think of this as a multidimensional space. So this is a takes place in several dimensions, and this is the kind of potential that was also occurred in this BKL analysis. Now, as I said, you still have quite a sum of terms, and it's still very complicated. But now there's an essential simplification, and the simplification is the following: as beta goes to infinity, these exponentials become sharper and sharper. Now, the way I've written here is a little bit sloppy. You can do a more rigorous analysis by using what we call hyperbolic coordinates. But the picture doesn't change. So in this limit, as you approach the singularity, this exponential wall becomes sharper and sharper, and in the limit it becomes like a sharp wall, like an infinite wall. So we say that the soft walls, the exponential barriers, where you can sort of penetrate a little bit, become hard, sharp walls in this limit. And these sharp walls are defined by as hyperplanes in this beta space. So this is a little bit like when you think about this potential as some kind of complicated mountainscape. And suppose you are in a valley, and then of course it's a very complicated problem to describe the trajectories. However, what happens in this limit is that the mountain tops in some sense go to infinity, and at that point you just need to worry about the walls that are, or potential walls that are next to you, and you can forget everything that's behind it.
We know there are certain matter types like scalar fields that break the chaotic behavior.
Yes, I will come to that.
The attitude here is, well, I have other matter fields and then...
Well, it depends on the kind of theory. I will give you a precise criterion for chaos versus non-chaos.
Another question, you may have addressed this, but I didn't understand it. Wouldn't you think if you integrate out some degrees of freedom, you get higher derivative equations for the remaining degrees of freedom?
Well, it's not quite integrate out in that sense. So you should don't take it too literal.
These beta degrees of freedom are coupled to other degrees
yes,
of freedom,
right.
Whose dynamics is not part of this system of equations.
Right? It's sort of, right.
Only coming in through this potential.
Right.
I'm saying I would have thought it would come in, it would have forced, there shouldn't be any autonomous dynamics with the same number of derivatives for the betas. It shouldn't be enough to modify the potential. Somehow there are just more degrees of freedom, and that translates generally into higher derivatives.
Well, you don't see it in this approximation. But can we maybe...
Or is this derived from the...
No, this is in some sense derived from the original Hamiltonian. You just look at how things behave generically in this limit. But as I said, this is the simplification this is the main simplification that occurs. That's why this BKL picture makes things so simple. And as you will see, it becomes even simpler because now, instead of these exponential potentials, we now have sharp walls which are defined by these equations, and this equation simply defines a hyperplane in beta space. So in some sense, now what happens is that the particle moves, and then it hits these walls and gets reflected. And then the whole theory is characterized by what kind of region, wedge-like region, you get in beta space. So what kind of walls do you get? Let me flash this because we don't need to know too much about this. As I said, there are various walls, and they come from the elimination of, in this picture, in this sense, of various degrees of freedom. There are centrifugal walls, and then there are here these curvature walls, certain linear forms, and they are associated with the original BKL analysis. And there are also other walls that are associated with other kinds of matter fields. Now, when you these wall forms are certain vectors, you can calculate their norm with respect to this original metric as it is given to us from Einstein's theory. And then one finds that all these walls are time-like, which means the associated hyperplanes have space-like normal vector, which means that the reflections against these walls belong to the orthogonous Lorentz group in this beta space. I will maybe say something about, well, if I get to it, also about higher order curvatures, but in this classic analysis, without higher order corrections, the only space-like walls so far known are cosmological constant walls coming from the cosmological constant. I will show a picture so you can... Here's a picture of what happens. The whole dynamics in this limit becomes simplified in the sense, as I said, it's a relativistic motion. It gets modified by reflections on sharp walls. And these sharp walls are made up by time-like. They are time-like walls, which means they're more inclined than the outer surface of this light cone. And this light cone is in the space of beta variables. So what we have now is, so here's the beta space, and here we have in green, those are the walls, and here you see the intersection of the walls, and the walls sort of define, as I said, a wedge-like region, and then the motion, the effective motion in these beta variables is simply a linear motion until this beta particle hits the wall, gets reflected, and then moves again like a freak Kasner particle and gets reflected and so on. So in the BKL descriptions, these would be the Kasner motion, free Kasner motion, and the Kasner bounds is effectively described by these reflections. Now in this picture, it becomes now very simple to decide whether a theory, now for each theory you have to sort of figure out what this wedge looks like, but it is now very simple to immediately say whether theory exhibits chaos or not. Namely, if this wedge, by the way, this is a space-time picture of this billiard. The billiard table, if you like, is obtained by slicing like here. And then you see it's a very funny kind of billiard because the cushions of the billiard recede from you, which means that every time the ball gets reflected, it also gets redshifted. So here we have this wedge, and if this wedge is contained in the forward light cone in this beta space, then there are infinitely many reflections. Why? Because the motion here is always, well, you can't see it here, is always along light-like rays, and because the hyperplanes are time-like, they're more inclined, so no matter in which direction this particle goes, eventually it will hit a wall and be reflected, and you can see that it will happen an infinite number of times. If, on the other hand, the wedge is situated such that it sort of extends beyond the light cone, then there will be some reflections until this particle is directed towards the direction here where this is opened up beyond the light cone, and then the particle will just keep going, but it will never hit the wall again. So simply by looking at this kind of thing, you can decide whether there are infinitely many reflections or only finitely many. So in this way, you can sort of rederive some results that have been known for a long time. Namely, this is a very convenient method to check whether any given model of matter-coupled gravity does or doesn't have these chaotic oscillations. So for example, one recovers the result that Einstein's theory in four dimensions exhibits chaotic behavior, which is the original BKL result. You can also see that the Kasner-like behavior, that the chaotic oscillations cease once your space-time dimension is greater than 10. So in 11 space-time dimensions, the theory's pure gravity is no longer chaotic. Or it can also happen that the theory that's initially non-chaotic, if you add matter fields, becomes chaotic again. And the case in point is 11-dimensional supergravity, which lives in 11 dimensions. So if it were just pure gravity in 11 dimensions, it wouldn't have these chaotic oscillations. But there's an extra matter field in this theory, namely the three-form field. And this three-form field adds in another wall, which is such that chaos is reinstated. You can also derive results like when you introduce a dilaton that will lead to cessation of chaotic behavior and so on. Now, the remarkable result is...
dimensional reduction, we take 11 and have nothing, and then the dimension reduced out of its form.
Well, we here anyway look at a one-dimensional reduction, so you would omit some... you see, one way to understand why there's no chaos in Gaudi-like models, which is like doing a two-dimensional reduction, is in some sense you some walls disappear in this reduction, and then you see that the motion is no longer impeded by a wall, and then it becomes regular. Anyway, all the theories, the supersymmetric theories that we have come across in over the last 20 years, they're all such that they are chaotic. You might have hoped that, say, type 2b supergravity is such that this chaos ceases, but it's precisely those theories, that all of them have chaotic behavior as you approach the initial singularity.
Someone can ask it. I'm still a little bit confused. So, I think the difference between what things like, David or Beverly, etc.
Yes.
They kind of use field equations. And here you are using more like a super Hamiltonian.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, surely there must be some gauge fixing or something that is going on. I mean, like, for example, does some simplification like what they talk about happen? Is it true that time derivatives dominate space derivatives? And that's kind of a meaningless question unless one fixes gauge.
Well, we have fixed gauges. I didn't spell this out sufficient. In my original metric ansatz, the gauge with the pseudo-Gaussian, take a pseudo-Gaussian gauge for the met. Yes, we do fix gauge degrees of freedom. Yes, absolutely.
For example, when David does, he uses trace k to constant hypersurfaces. Do you do something like that?
No, we don't do that, no.
Do you have a preferred foliation, or what does time derivative...
Well, I guess there's a preferred foliation, yes, but...
So his foliation is basically the traditional one.
Yes, right.
Right. Your synchronous coordinates based on proper time for the singularity. So the problem, I mean, that's perfectly reasonable thing to do. But they were criticized by various people because, if you don't know what the singularity is like, how do you know that this proper time foliation, from the singularity works? For numerics, you can't use proper time from the singularity because you don't know where the singularity is until you encounter it. And that's why, it's more convenient to use these case data instead. But it probably comes down to the same thing.
But I don't have the same confusion thing, actually. You can't start with singularity unless you do something like random time differently. But you can't start with singularity at proper time, particularly in this Hamiltonian framework. So what foliation condition, what gauge condition is it in which?
You just take a metric ansatz and you plug it into the
ansatz. Right.
And ask whether it's consistent. That in particular,
but you might be restricting the space of species. Is my obvious question.
Sure. No matter what you do, whether you do it this way or whether you do it numerically, there's always
numerically it's obvious. But this way, not obvious.
Yeah, you're always restricted. In fact, apparently, which one of the KL was that gave some, you know, early lecture on this stuff at Cambridge, and they always said, you know, we found the general solution, and then, you know, Hawking would always interrupt them and say, no, you found the collective solution. And sure, I mean, short of some, you know, all-encompassing theorem, which we don't have anywhere near the mathematical machinery for, there's no way of saying that you know, the general solution looks like this.
Yes, right.
Say it's yes. Classical solutions. You know, it's like this near the singularity, and we haven't found any other classes.
So far, you haven't done anything with the excited string model.
No, I'm not talking about string theory here. This is still this is a field theory. Einstein's theory coupled to
Right, but you would expect that near the singularity,
yes. Yeah. But that's I'll at the moment this is simply an attempt to reformulate BKL for arbitrary matter coupled systems, maybe in a heuristic way. There's no claim here that the heuristic that we have rigorous theorems. But as I said, my main emphasis here is not so much on studying these singularities, because the main emphasis is actually this. Because we now make the connection to what's called hidden symmetries in supergravity theories. Namely, it so turns out, and this was first realized by Damour and Hainaut, that for many theories of interest, which includes all of these, but many others, this beta space of scale factors can be identified with a Cartan subalgebra of a certain Lie algebra. Or to be more precise, the Lie algebra is an indefinite Kac-Moody algebra. And the analogy which you find is the following. Well, first of all, you associate or identify this beta space of scale factors with a Cartan subalgebra of such an algebra. And secondly, one notices that these time-like walls, which are defined by certain normal vectors, namely these wall forms, are associated with real roots of such an algebra. And the dominant walls, corresponding to the dominant potential contributions, are associated with the so-called simple roots of such an algebra. And then the Kasner bounces are interpreted as Weyl reflections. Its elements of the Weyl group consists of, it's something that acts in the space of roots, and one reflects upon the hyperplanes that are orthogonal to the roots. So at this point this may seem a little far-fetched, but it seemed like at first almost like a miracle. When you take these wall forms and you take the metric as it comes from this Wheeler de Witt superspace metric, and you calculate the matrix of scalar products of these leading wall coefficients, what you get is exactly the Cartan matrix of some such algebra.
But this is only for the product series come from string and M series?
No, they also. I have another. I show another example, namely just pure Einstein gravity. And then, in fact, there's even a sort of group theoretical way to characterize the presence or absence of chaotic oscillations.
So it's your idea that this somehow is a reflection of some deeper phenomenon that would happen in the...
I'll come to that. You see, the idea is here, we simply look at this, and then we see evidence of a certain symmetry, and the next question then will be, what is this symmetry and how is it realized? But let me first show you what the symmetry... Yeah?
How strong is this debug? In the sense that I give some definite metric and a bunch of data. What are the capability conditions on that?
There are certainly examples of theories like, say, Einstein coupled to Maxwell in arbitrary number of dimensions, for which this is not true. But it just turns out to be true certainly for this class of theories, for all the theories actually that we have encountered in this in the context of local supersymmetry, but also for some others, like just pure gravity. So here's the example of pure gravity, where one has centrifugal walls, and one also has the curvature walls that were studied by BKL. And one looks at the leading walls, one sees that there are three of them, because it takes three, because of the three-dimensional beta space, so we have three hyperplanes that will define one of these wedges. And then one calculates their scalar products, and then one gets this kind of matrix, and this matrix is indeed the Cartan matrix of some indefinite Katz-Moody algebra. So you can also, in this case, study the Weyl group, which was studied more than 20 years ago by Feingold and Frankel. And then you can also describe, have an effective description of this billiard on the Poincaré disk in two dimensions.
Is this group related to the dimensional reduction of this whole?
Well, there was a conjecture. Since we're getting to what is this symmetry, let me just tell you that at least those among you who are familiar with Dynkin diagrams will recognize what symmetries these are. So what we have here, each one of them defines an SL2 subalgebra, and so this node is associated with what's called the Ehlers group, and this here we have an SL3, which is the SL3 that acts by special linear transformations on the frame field spatial tribine. And when you put these two together, you get what's called the Garrosh group, which also been around for a long time, which is this group of symmetries that one obtains when Einstein's theory is reduced to two dimensions, that is, solutions of Einstein's equations with two commuting Killing vectors. Now, the case I'm more interested in is, of course, maximal supergravity. And in this case, one gets this kind of Dynkin diagram, where the walls, again, all centrifugal walls, and this is the wall that comes in because of presence of the three-form field. So at this point, this simply gives a description, a group theoretical description of the kind of billiard. If you want to do BKL analysis for 11-dimensional supergravity, then the billiard is effectively described by the Weyl chamber associated with this Dynkin diagram. Well, at this point, you might now say, well, we could just leave it at that because we've now found an effective description. We've equated the beta space with the Cartan subalgebra of a certain Katz-Moody algebra, and so the roots provide a nice description of this billiard. On the other hand, we all know that with such diagrams, these are not just root diagrams, but with each root diagram there's associated a certain symmetry, and the question is now, what is this symmetry, and does it mean, can we understand what this symmetry could mean in this context? So rather than stopping here, we say that we have found indications here of some huge symmetry which is associated with some such Dynkin diagram. Well, yeah?
Your question, I was asking a few minutes ago. If you take these theories and just pack them out of torus,
yes,
down to one dimension,
yes,
you find the same, yes, symmetry in,
yes,
these theories.
Yes.
So in all cases, the symmetry you see from the sort of behavior in the higher dimensions near a singularity agrees with what you get from the Royal computation.
Yes, right.
And this only applies to those supersymmetric gravity, where you could say...
Well, this, for each theory, you have a special kind of Dynkin diagram, but the one that is obtained for this maximally extended theory is this one. And now, I'm not going to tell you what this is, but one way to think about this Lie algebra is that it's the analog, so an infinite dimension analog of the finite dimensional exceptional Lie algebra. You may have heard of exceptional Lie algebras. E8 is the most, the biggest and most beautiful among the finite dimensional ones, and E10 among the infinite dimensional Lie algebras, E10 occupies a similarly distinguished position. It's in some sense, if you were to give a table of Kac-Moody algebras, a classification of such algebras, this algebra is at the, in some sense, at the end of the classification. So what you find is that maximal supergravity gets associated with this maximally extended Lie algebra. This is actually quite an amazing result, because if you remember, how was this theory arrived at? Originally, maximally extended supergravity was obtained by restricting maximum spin to 2. That was because we didn't want to have higher spins. And then over the years, people have realized if one wants a supersymmetric extension of Einstein's theory and make it as supersymmetric as you possibly can, then 11-dimensional supergravity, this is it. There's nothing, or appears to be nothing beyond. Now, in... Yes, it's a... No, it's a Lie algebra. I will show in a moment what kind of Lie algebra it is. Because now, as a physicist, one would, of course, like, if I tell you I have a Lie algebra, then as a physicist, you would ask, okay, then give me the Lie algebra generators and the structure constants. Give me the list of, just write down. Just like for SL2, it's J1, J2, J3. Yes.
Sorry, if I start with just 6-dimensional pure gravity.
Yes.
And would you get also such kind of...
Yes, you would also get...
And would the group the same, or would the algebra the same as the dimensional reduced, the 6-dimensional gravity?
Well, in 6-dimensional gravity, you would get an algebra that's of a certain type. I can give you the Dinkin diagram. It's an extension of the affine SLN diagram.
So that's the same as you found...
Yeah. It's a certain. I showed you the one for 4-dimensional gravity, and 5- and 6-dimensional gravity. You just keep adding notes to the Dinkin diagram.
So, for the 3-dimensional, or I guess 4 space time dimensional gravity case, you identified these with things like the Euler's
perturbation. Yes, right.
So these are things that basically take solutions with.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's going to be slightly different, but I will get to, because after all we're trying to understand singularities, and I'm sort of building my way towards that goal. Yeah. Yes. Well, we'll get to the question how to sort of, I mean, it seems like when I do a reduction to 1 dimensions, I lose a lot of information, and the question is, can I recover this information? But let me first of all say a few words about, because at this point I've just given you a Dinkin diagram, but you don't have, at the moment you don't know what this Lie algebra is. In fact, nobody knows. However, let me first describe it in terms of roots, because I would like you to keep in mind, say, something like SL3 or SU3. Everybody has seen this root diagram. There's a finite number of roots. The roots live in a Euclidean space, and it's such that with each root you have one Lie algebra generator. Now, these indefinite Kac-Moody algebras are a different type. Indefinite means several things, but in particular it means that these roots live not in a Euclidean space or Euclidean lattice, but a Lorentzian lattice, which means that there are infinitely many of them. And so here I've drawn sort of a light cone in this root space. And there are certain roots which are space-like. In mathematics, they're called real roots that lie on a hyperboloid like this. So you should picture here lots of dots corresponding to elements of this lattice. Then there are null roots, which are long, lie on the light cone. And finally, there are time-like roots, which are sort of embedded here. And there's an infinite number of them, and more of them as you go up here. So to repeat, the difference between finite-dimensional Lie algebras and these infinite-dimensional ones is that you have an infinite number of roots. You have an indefinite metric on this root space. So for the people who know a little more about this, there's something called affine Katz-Moody algebras, but this is still a very simple case because you stay on this light cone, but you don't go inside. So how could you possibly characterize such an algebra? As I said, physicist's way of characterizing such an algebra is I simply give the list of Lie algebra elements. And this is not possible in this way. It's sort of recursively defined. But what you can do is you can sort of slice this root space into slices, which are numbered by so-called levels. And in each level, there's a finite number of Lie algebra generators. And in particular, you can sort of classify, you can do this in different ways. And it corresponds to classifying these Lie algebra elements in terms of tensors of some simpler subalgebra. So for example, for E10, that's again more for the experts, you could try to give a list by omitting this, and then every generator is at the same time a tensor of this subalgebra, which is SL10. Hence, I should be able to write down a list of Lie algebra generators in terms of SL10 tensors. Each of them is an SL10 tensor. So we've done that, and it's infinite. And at home I have 300 pages of tables. This is the last. This is how far we've been able to go. And I'm not showing you any details. I'm just, because many people don't realize what a monster of a Lie algebra this is. What you see here, details really don't matter so much. Here you have the list of SL10 tensors in terms of Dynkin labels. Dynkin label is, I give you some Young tableau, about every Young tableau does occur, and the numbers in this last column tell you how many times these tensors occur. So up to where we've done the search, we've already found 4.4 billion SL10 tensors. It's just a monstrous Lie algebra. And if you think this is bad, no matter how far you go, it will get worse because of what's called exponential growth, which means that these numbers here in the last column for any given Young tableau will get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Is there a Lie algebra question?
Yes, there's a Lie algebra. Recursive.
I don't want vector constants as one. I want a vector space. Is it a Banach space, Hilbert space? What is the infinity basis space? Structure constants are just interlinear mappings from this space cross itself into itself, right? So you can just tell us that there is a Hilbert space is this.
Well, the unique
mapping, which has a property is that when reduced to roots, it gives you this. And then I would be happy. But I don't see that. I just see sort of pictures.
No, you can. This is at the moment at purely algebraic level. I mean, at a formal, it's an infinite dimensional vector space. And I can put a norm on it, and I can turn it into a Hilbert space if I want to. But at the moment, this is not. It's like, you take SL2, J1, J2, J3, and now you put a norm on that.
It's finite dimension. I don't need a Hilbert space, except to write it.
Well,
the infinite dimensional spaces, right? I mean, very different of these, if it's a Banach.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I agree. But this is an aspect that hasn't been studied. I know that there are zillions of vector space topologies that you can put on this. I mean, either norm or just in the form of turn into a topological, locally convex or whatever vector space. But at the moment, I'm not concerned with this. I just wanted to illustrate what kind of Lie algebra this is, and just to show you how little we understand, I go back to page one of this table, and what you see here. So this is how the Lie algebra starts out, and there's the subalgebra in terms of which I want to characterize it. And then I give you the tensors, and you notice that, you probably cannot see it, but at the beginning, the representations which occur are precisely the representations that are known to occur in 11-dimensional supergravity. First level, we get a three-form field or three-form antisymmetric tensor. At the second level, we get a six-form field, which we interpret as the dual magnetic six-form. And at the third level, we get something that's a field can be thought of as a magnetic dual of the graviton. And if you do other slicings, you will find all the representation content. Slicings of the same algebra, you will find the representation content of 2b and 2a a supergravity. Now we know that these field representations are associated with certain objects that people talk about in string theory, like d brains and m brains and so on, and you know that these are supposed to be related by duality symmetries. And just to illustrate the level of or ignorance here with regard to this symmetry, is that about every paper on duality symmetry in string theory is, that I've seen at least, is confined to this very beginning of the table. So this shows you that in terms of duality invariance, there's just, you know, we're just scratching the surface, and there's a vast ocean of
the brains,
it's a purely algebraic level. For example, here we have the three form that couples to the M2 brain, six form couples to the, yes, I see the forms, and you similarly for 2A to B, you see the form fields that couple to the DP brains. But here it's just at the level where you say we have certain form fields and they couple to these objects. And this is also how far one can go with the Lie algebra itself, calculating structure constants and so on. And if you have a very diligent and very gifted student, maybe you can go up to here or so. Well, this is one of the tricky points, or at least the points that, well, I might say points that hasn't been fully understood. You can dualize Einstein theory at the linearized level, in the sense that you can, this is not dualization in terms of the Riemann tensor, but you try to do the same thing that you try to do for Maxwell theory when you introduce a dual magnetic field, which is such that the field equations for one of them imply the Bianchi equations for the other. You can do this also with a linearized metric. The representation which you then find is a sort of mixed Young tableau, which is precisely the thing that appears here in this table. So the question is now, what does this all mean? And I'm not sure how far I can get with this, but at least I would like to sort of explain the philosophy here. In supergravity, we have come, I mean, there was another way of getting these symmetries that has already been mentioned, namely if you take 11-dimensional supergravity and two-dimensional reduction, you know that there are these duality symmetries. And for a long time, it was known or conjectured that as you go to one dimension, then there should be this E10 symmetry. Now, on the other hand, it seems like when you are in one dimension, you're not left with very much. But as you can see here, you're left with a huge, huge Lie algebra. And now, in order to, I've shown this picture here again, but now slightly modified. And I guess there's not so much time left. I would like to just explain the philosophy that's behind this approach and what this all might mean. At the beginning, I showed you this diagram, but the diagram simply extended to t equals zero in a sort of preferred slicing. And then we were interested in what happens as I take the field equations to t equals zero. Now here, we're all convinced that, in fact, you cannot extend the theory all the way down to t equals zero, but as you reach t equals t Planck, then some other theory should take over. And in fact, this was already an old objection to the BKL picture by Zeldovich, because because Seldovich said, looking at this billiard which I showed you before, you can calculate that, you know, there's maybe a handful of oscillations as you go back until it doesn't take many oscillations to reach the Planck time. So he said, what's the point of making all this fuss about chaos versus AVD, because there's anyway only a finite number of oscillations when you reach the Planck scale. So at this workshop, there's been quite some discussion about singularity resolution, what kind of theory could take over here. And as far as I can tell, I was relieved to see that, you know, many people are just as confused as I'm myself about this issue. But I see two kinds of resolutions here. One is, may I say, in the framework of geometrodynamics, where one says that somehow the space is still there, but just like in the hydrogen atom, rather than looking at trajectories in this relativistic superspace, we should be looking at wave functions, and then the singularity gets smoothed out in some sense in the same way as it gets smoothed out in the hydrogen atom. So that means that in some sense these structures are still there, but instead of classical trajectories you look at wave functions, and maybe then if you have some time parameter, then you can describe bounces or whatever. Now here the idea is, or our proposal is actually different, and it's more in spirit with this BKL philosophy. Namely, the idea is that as we go down here, down in this regime, the Einstein theory, whatever, should be replaced by a one-dimensional sigma model, but a sigma model that's based on this infinite-dimensional Lie algebra. So it means, in some sense, we take seriously this BKL observation that somehow the space becomes more and more negligible as you go to this limit, and then what takes over here is this one-dimensional sigma model and this gigantic Lie algebra, which is so huge that among its it contains also information about the spatial gradients, and we're sort of trying to, on the BKL side, one would try to make some kind of expansion in the space tension where spatial derivatives are sort of quantified by their weight. That's on the one side, and on the group theory side we're trying to associate this with a group theoretical expansion or Lie algebra theoretical expansion in terms of heights of roots, and this works up to a certain point. And now you notice that in such a description, indeed in this region there is no more space has completely disappeared. And if you think about quantizing a la Wheeler-DeWitt in frozen formalism, also time has disappeared. In some sense, space then gets sucked up into this Lie algebra. There's no more space-time, but there's just a huge Lie algebra. And I might also say that in such an approach, the issue of background independence becomes, in some sense, a non-issue. Because background independence, I might say, it's something like you still have background structures, but you try to formulate the theory as quantization in such a way that there is no more, that there's no dependence on given background structures. But in this framework, the background is gone, and therefore there's no more background dependence.
Can you apply the philosophy in vacuum in four dimensions? What does the sigma model look like?
Well, the sigma model in that case would be based on this. Well, I haven't given you any details of what it would look like, but then you would take this this Lie algebra, which is called AE3. It's the simplest algebra of this type. So, at first you might think this is totally crazy, because how can a one-dimensional theory capture all the information that's in a field theory and much, much, much more? But actually what you can show is that the information in this one-dimensional model is enough to fix the Lagrangian of 11-dimensional supergravity, 2a, 2b, to sort of match it in a certain sense. such that you get essentially all the results that we have known over the years follow from local supersymmetry, and they all come out of this single Kac-Moody algebra. Yes.
So, I mean, all of the space is just a single
in some sense, that's what should happen. I should say this is.
I mean, before you kind of said that, you know, different points go down the order.
Right.
Now you are kind of bunching them all.
Well, as I said, this is, I wanted to describe you my philosophy and the vision. It's not, we're still very far from actually. Well, this, you have this. If you have look at the sigma model as a set of constraints that you see becomes the constraints associated with spatial diffeomorphisms, gauge transformations of the free-form field, and so on.
Well, you're describing it as if time goes backwards, namely
that you see
space
right.
disappearing and
yes.
eventually end up in a sigma model.
Yes.
Suppose I would start from the sigma model, would I be able to see space reappear?
Well, you would like to see space emerge from this Lie algebra, and this means sort of studying what happens at this transition. And this is where we have still very, not very many results, but I believe the results are enough to show that if something comes out of there in terms of space-time field theory, then it's going to be 11-dimensional supergravity plus something else.
How about this? A classic picture, but I mean, I guess I always have this confusion, so I can ask it every time. Where is H bar in all this? And is this all going to happen just on the classical level?
Well, that's.
And if that is the case, why do you like to keep Planck there?
Well, that's the in the 11-dimensional supergravity, that's the only constant that appears in it.
It's just something classical theory.
Yes.
There's a real, at a philosophical level, I do think that there is a really fundamental tension, namely this one and the second one that was just mentioned about, point decoupling, at the philosophical level,
yes.
Point decoupling and becoming only one single model.
There is some tension, I must say. I don't think I have a really good answer to that question, because it also somehow concerns the questions: how does the field theory emerge out of this model? And of course, one can think about quantizing this model. So far, we've just been looking at, if you like, the quote-unquote classical theory. But given this theory, you can also set up a sort of quantization where you replace the Hamiltonian by Hamiltonian constraint. So that's in principle possible. So at this point, I'm not sure whether I should stop. Because let me just say in two words what I wanted to say. And one way to approach the problem of singularities in strings here, this was the higher order curvature corrections. One knows that one can effectively describe the quantum effects in strings in terms of an effective action, which is an infinite series in the Riemann tensor and the associated field strength. And this has been calculated in string theory. These corrections are known to order r to the fourth. It's known that 11-dimensional supergravity does have such corrections that have been calculated. And it's a certain expression in terms which is quartic in the Riemann tensor plus other corrections. And what we've been trying to do is to associate these corrections with certain roots. Let me see. I don't have the. I showed you the picture of the root space with this. Here we go. So far, what we have been able to do in terms of matching simply contains the root out here, but the real difficulty of this with these Lie algebras is up here with the time-like roots. And we've been able to show that one can associate a certain of these time-like roots with the higher-order corrections in string theory. And in particular, one can show that if one looks at corrections of the type Riemann to some power n, that they're... These corrections are compatible with the structure of E10 only if n is equal to 3k plus 1. So the corrections appear at orders r to the fourth, r to the seventh, and so on. And this is a result that had been obtained previously in string theory, but in a completely different way. And we've been able to show that certain corrections which are there can all be associated with certain finite dimensional roots here. So it could be, coming back to your question, that we have a sort of effective description in this sigma model that at once, in some sense, also takes into account the effect of higher order curvature corrections that one would normally associate with the quantum theory. But as I said, I don't think I have a really good, because every time we meet, we have this discussion. Yes. No, but I think it's a perfectly valid question. And
I only ask because this one might have evolved.
Right. I mean, as I said, I mean the real problem at the moment for us is sort of extending what we here have this been able to fix or match this sigma model to the space-time field theory for up to a certain degree, but we have not been able to push it further. What we would like is to sort of extend this further in such a way that all the information about the space dependence of the theory gets captured by the Lie algebra. And at the kinematical level, one can see that in this table of representations, there's more than enough room for that. In particular, there's room to contain all the information about the spatial gradients in this theory. So maybe I should stop here. Well, one thing that's also nice about this Lie algebra is that normally with Lie algebras there are Casimir operators and their number increases with the rank of the Lie algebra. With the infinite dimensional Lie algebras there's a single invariant and it's just the quadratic Casimir. So if you write a Lagrangian for that theory, it's a unique Lagrangian. At least I should say polynomial invariants. There may be non-polynomial ones, but they're not known. Yeah.
Left to the quantum
theory by looking at a given possible solution, the
limit of a given quantum solution. Yes. Would you be inspired in the same direction by looking at sort of different things, like non singularities or to describe? I mean.
Well, I don't know how to describe. What special about space-like singularities? I wouldn't know how to describe time-like singularities in this framework. It's very much tied to this BKL picture, and maybe I should emphasize that we were not looking for this because we knew on the one hand that there was this prediction as you do the reduction of the theory to one dimension there should be such a large symmetry, and coming from the BKL where also in some sense one has was naturally led to look at one-dimensional reductions. It was only then that one tries to one sees realize that it really fits together, and there's the one, you know, one should try to associate the expansion one is trying to make on the BKL side with higher and higher order spatial gradients in some sense with an expansion one would like to make in this Lie algebra.
Maybe one last question.
Yeah, but if I follow the philosophy of the Ritter-Levy condensation, that would like to consider the wave function in your hyperbolic.
Yes.
So what would you give significance to this wave function?
Well, that's the same question of what significance would I attach to a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation if I had one.
Right. So suppose.
But you see here the idea, if this were really true, this wave function, this Wheeler-DeWitt wave function would have, you know, very it would have a sort of group theoretical significance in the sense it would be something like a modular form or something over this huge algebra.